Testing 1, 2. Can you guys hear me? Give thumbs up or thumbs down. Okay, great.
Brody,
hey, can you guys talk?
Yeah, can you hear us?
Yeah, we're good. Can you get their volume up a little more, though? Yeah, you guys are good.
Great, thank you.
We all talk again for just a second?
Testing 1, 2, 3. This is Steve.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, January 26th, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative Carpenter, Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And as we start, just a reminder, if you can mute your cell phones. And at this meeting, the committee will be adopting committee substitutes for House Bill 281 and House Bill 282, the FY23 operating budget and the mental health budget. Followed by a presentation from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The committee substitutes that we plan to adopt today are the governor's proposed budgets, and the only changes made are technical and structural changes made by legislative finance, as well as legislative legal. And so with that, just putting these on the table. So do I have a motion on the first committee substitute, which is HB 281, version B?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 281 Finance, Work Draft 32-GH2686/B, mark stated 12122 as our working document.
Thank you. And I'll just also note for the record that we have with us Representative Wool. And so motion has been made. I will object for the purpose of an explanation and call my staff up to explain the changes that were made in version B. So with that, Mr. Anderson, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before the committee today is committee substitute for House Bill 281, the operating budget. The committee substitute reflects only the technical and drafting changes made by Legislative Finance Division and Legislative Legal in accordance with the Legislative Drafting Manual and is more consistent with legislative drafting practices. Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out that there are a couple major changes that had made in the committee substitute, and if the committee would like to follow along, I'd like to point those out. Starting on, if you have the bill in front of you, starting on page one. In the title, there was a reference made to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, or better known as the CBR, in the title, in the governor's version. That has been removed since at current point there is no section requiring a CBR appropriation, so that has been removed from the title.
You got a question, Representative Rasmussen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair. If the legislature did amend language to include a backfill provision, would that then again warrant a title change?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct. At the time, the CBR section would be added. At that point, the title would be changed.
Okay. Please continue.
Next, we have going all the way to page 55. On page 55, starting at line one, actually, it's section seven, and it would read supplemental request for commerce, community, and economic development. This was moved up into the supplemental section of the bill. In the prior governor's version, this was not designated as a supplemental request, but it is. So, in consistent practices, supplemental requests for the previous fiscal year goes before the current fiscal year language sections, and so that has been moved up from its previous location.
Sorry, and the previous location was where again?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the previous section number that it used to be. I believe it would have been, it's in, if you go to the current CCED section, which would be found on page 59. Excuse me, page 58. You would notice that the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, section 14, is that section there refers to FY23's current language section, and the supplemental section that you see in section 7 was moved up to the top. So the very first sections you see in the language are normally supplemental requests.
I don't see any further questions.
Moving on to page 56.
Can I? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Anderson, is that a reflection that what's being asked of the committee is to consolidate the supplemental and the FY23? Is that the effect of what you're saying?
Through the chair, we do have, I believe, Marie Marks online from Ledge Legal for drafting practices, but this really is just a consistent legislative drafting practice that in the structure of the language sections, there's a consistent order that has been followed. And so the governor had not designated this as a supplemental request, but in fact it was. So they've reclassified it and moved it up as with the proper designation of a supplemental request. But Ms. Marks could probably answer further.
Thank you. And I might be interested in just getting another take on this. Ms. Marks, can you put yourself on the record? Just curious what your explanation on this one is.
Yes, absolutely. For the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair and Representative Josephson, this is not making any substantive changes. It is purely reorganizing the structure of the bill and how we reorganize appropriation bills to be in conformance with how we historically draft them in the legislative drafting manual is all the supplemental appropriations go at the front of the bill. And that's really to make it easier for you as a legislature and also members of the public to find things in the same place every year. So the supplemental provisions will go first, and then the appropriations for the upcoming fiscal year will go second.
Great, thank you very much, Ms. Marks. Representative Carpentry.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I do not want to debate semantics here, really. I guess my question would be, where is the sum of $1 million appropriated from? Is that from fiscal year 22 funds or from fiscal year 23 funds? Because the Section 7 specifically says that it's being for costs associated with fiscal years ending fiscal year 22 and fiscal year 23. So it's covering costs in both fiscal years, but I don't know where the money is actually coming from. Which fiscal year is it coming from?
Is that a Mr. Anderson or a Ms. Cunningham? You want to take a first stab at that, Brody?
Ms. Cunningham could probably, maybe I'm reading through it as well, so okay. Maybe.
Ms. Cunningham, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, for the record, this is Kelly Cunningham with Legislative Finance. Those receipts, they come from insurance receipts, and the department also has carry forward. I believe they had about $6.8 million in carry forward from prior years. I'll verify that number, but I believe that's the number from prior year carry forward.
Prior year carry forward. Okay, thank you. Representative Carpenter?
I guess a follow-up then for Ms. Cunningham. From the administration's point of view, they view this as a supplemental request as well.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that is correct. I verified with OMB when we identified this, and they said, yes, it should be a supplemental.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Anderson.
Moving on to page 56, down at the bottom of page 56, you will see a single line, section 12. Alaska Permanent Fund, and we will continue on to page 57, ending at line 22. This is the Alaska Permanent Fund, and once again, this was just restructured by section order, and I would like to walk the committee through the different subsections. So you have subsection A, which begins on page 56, line 31, and then moves through page 57, line 3. This is now reflects the mandatory royalty deposits into the principal. Subsection B.
I'm sorry, Mr. Anderson, you said the mandatory royalty payment, so I assume you're referring to the 25% for the post-79 fields, is that correct?
Through the chair, this is the mandatory royalties.
Oh, I'm sorry, the 50%.
Pre-79 fields. The post-79 fields will be subsection B.
Okay, thank you.
Subsection B, page 57, line 4 through 7, is the deposits for the post-79 field royalties, which the co-chairman just referenced. Subsection C, page 57, lines 8 through 14, is both the POMV payout and the governor's 50-50 PFD. And then finally, subsection D, page 57, lines 15 through 17, is the deposit into the Alaska Capital Income Fund.
So, Mr. Anderson, none of the numbers have changed from what the governor is requesting or putting in or doing anything with. You're just this has been reordered and that's all?
Through the chair, that is correct. No numbers have changed. This is just a structural rechange of subsections.
And this subsection was later in the language section?
It was the actual section 12 didn't change. The subsection orders did change, and Ms. Marks could explain a little bit further on how things were moved around to be more consistent.
Ms. Marks, can you comment on this?
Absolutely. Again, for the record, this is Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Chair Foster, we have a certain order that we keep the permanent fund sections in every year. Again, this is for ease of you as the legislature and the public, so you can find things consistently in the same place. And so we just reorder those sections. The governor's version of the bill, version A, started with an appropriation for permanent fund dividends, but we always start that section with the amount required to be deposited under the Constitution. And so we just have a certain order. So we put those sections that the governor had in the order that we consistently have put them historically.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carpenter and then Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just curious if Ms. Cunningham has any concerns with the technical organization of the bill. Since it's, you know, not dealing with anything super substantial like lots of money or PFD or anything like that.
Ms. Cunningham?
That was a joke.
Oh. I'm in robot mode over here. Wow, you got us. We have to. Wow, good one, Representative Rasmussen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair, is the section E, subsection E, with the inflation proofing, was that in the governor's proposed budget, or was this in addition in the committee substitute?
Through the chair, Representative, my apologies. In my little workup, I left off subsection E, but that has been in the, that was part of the governor's request as well. There's been no changes, so I just left it off of my little cheat sheet.
Representative Carpenter?
Yeah, sorry, I'm not a joker, so I'll just keep my jokes to myself from now on. I did want to hear from Ms. Cunningham as to whether she was concerned with the structural changes, and I will just be more direct next time.
Ms. Cunningham?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Carpenter, excuse me. Ledge Finance does not have any issues with the changes made by Ledge Legal on the organization.
Great, thank you. And Mr. Anderson?
Moving on to page 63. Starting on lines 14, going through page 65, line 14, this is section 19, Department of Health and Social Services. This was moved down. The governor's version had reflected it as a supplemental request, and legislative legal has moved it down into section what is now 19, because this is actually not a supplemental request. This is a appropriations extension that goes through fiscal year 23. So since it's not a supplemental, it was moved down into Hess's current location in the language section, which makes it section 19. Finally, page 68. Page 68, lines 4 through 14. This is section 25, Office of the Governor. It is standard practice for legislative legal to move both the Office of the Governor and the University of Alaska below the departments. And so the governor's office was moved farther down to making it section 25. And so it better reflects that practice. And then also there was an additional section called cost allocations, and that falls under the governor's request. So they merged a section that is no longer reflective in the bill with the governor's section. So you have section A, which is the appropriation, and then also section B, which is the cost allocations. And so these were moved into one single section with two subsections. Mr. Chairman, those are the major changes and differences in the committee substitute for House Bill 281.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions. And so with that, I will remove my objection, and I don't see any further objections. So seeing none, version B will become the working draft for HB 281. And so that now takes us over to HB 282, and I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 282 Finance, Work Draft 32-GH2687/B, Marks dated 1/20/22 as our working document.
Okay, thank you. And again, I will object for purposes of discussion. And if you could explain any changes, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you again, Co-Chair Foster. Once again, for the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. This committee substitute also for HB 282 reflects only the technical and drafting changes made by Legislative Finance and Legislative Legal. There is only one major change in this bill, and it's really easy to find. It's on page 1, lines 1 through 4. And that is the title. In the title, the previous version had referenced both capital requests and supplemental appropriations, and they have been removed from this because there is no longer any capital appropriations or supplemental requests that fall outside the scope of the mental health budget. If the committee remembers, in previous years, we've had to add things above and beyond what normally is inside the scope of the mental health budget, and references to those things outside the scope have been removed. So now the mental health budget reflects only those items that have come from the request of the Mental Health Trust Authority and then provided in the governor's budget submitted.
And so just for the folks who might be watching, just HB 281 was the state operating budget, and this before us right now is HB 282, which is the Alaska Mental Health Trust budget. And so are there any questions on the explanation that Brody just provided? So Brody, in a nutshell, what you're saying is the title has changed, and now the main difference is that because I see right here it says operating capital expenses But then I thought I heard you say capital was removed, but what you're saying is not that. Can you, one more time, just in a nutshell?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. So within the the mental health budget is a little unique that it does have about 8 major projects that the mental health board approves as capital projects that are reflected in the single bill. Those are those projects that are referenced in the current title, which say capital expenses. The removal of capital appropriations that were in the previous title referenced capital appropriations that were outside the scope of those mental health capital projects.
Good. All right. Okay. Okay. So with that, I don't see any questions from the committee. And I will remove my objection, and I don't see any further objections. So if there are none, then version B will become the working draft for HB 282. And so that now takes us to, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Up next, we have a presentation from the Mental Health Trust Authority, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up the teams, the video for this, and so at ease. And House Finance is back on record, and online to present today are Steve Williams, the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and Steve is joined by Anita Halterman, the Chair of the Board of Trustees. And so with that, Mr. Williams and Ms. Halterman, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you.
I'm Anita Halterman, and I am the current chair of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board of Trustees. I would like to recognize my fellow trustees who unfortunately could not be in the room to wave at you all, but they're listening in from our conference room. Rhonda Boyle is our current vice chair. Renee Berner is our program and planning committee chair. John Sturgeon is our resource management committee chair. Brent Fisher is our secretary and finance committee chair. Kevin Feynman is our Audit and Risk Committee Chair, and Chris Cook is a trustee. For more than 27 years, the Trust has been administering the Alaska Mental Health Trust, a perpetual trust, in order to improve the lives of trust beneficiaries. Alaska is fortunate to have a self-funded organization that supports state, local, and non-governmental partners in providing services and supports for vulnerable Alaskans. In the fiscal year of 2021, the Trust awarded more than $21.3 million in grants to partners that helped to improve the lives of Trust beneficiaries throughout the state. I'd like to acknowledge and thank all of those who have played a part in the formation of our unique state agency. It would be wonderful if every state had a mental health trust authority. We are fortunate that the Trust can serve as a supporting funder in system changes involving improvements that helped to implement a comprehensive mental health program plan in Alaska. The role the Trust plays in supporting efforts to provide funding and support for programs that improve the lives of our beneficiaries is evident. This work is demonstrated through the Trust's recent efforts to enhance our continuum of care, through our work to improve Alaska's behavioral health crisis response system, and through our ongoing communication efforts aimed at reducing the stigma experienced by our beneficiaries. Our standing trust focus areas and priorities recognize the need to improve and maximize the systems that serve our beneficiaries. And we continue to make progress as we engage with our partners who are addressing homelessness, providing addiction services, treatment services, working to reduce recidivism, and working in many ways to improve the lives of our trust beneficiaries. So how do we do this work? We do this through prudent financial management and through strategic management of our trust land assets. These efforts have placed the trust in a strong financial position. I'd like to acknowledge my fellow trustees and the trust staff for their continued efforts in managing the trust's cash and non-cash assets in a manner that supports the trust beneficiaries of today and tomorrow. And while we know that the last year brought many challenges, despite that, the trust made significant progress. In the past year, we finalized a major land exchange in Southeast Alaska that provides new opportunities to generate revenue for the trust. We underwent a productive legislative audit. We experienced record gains in our financial assets, and we made significant progress in implementing improvements to how Alaska responds to those experiencing psychiatric crisis. Before I close, I'd like to thank committee members for this opportunity to update you on our budget, our finances, and the work of, on behalf of our trust beneficiaries. I'd also like to publicly thank our partners across Alaska who are applying their energy and experience and expertise every day to improving the trust beneficiaries' outcomes. It is likely that every Alaskan has been impacted in some way by the behavioral health challenges that the trust beneficiaries experience. My family personally has been impacted, so this work is particularly meaningful to me, and I am grateful to serve as the chair of this board of this very important organization. I'd like to introduce Steve Williams. He is our new CEO, and Steve was selected by the Board of Trustees following a rigorous recruitment interviewing process. Me and my fellow trustees are excited to have him take on this new role. Steve has been with the trust for 16 years. 8 of those years, he has served as the organization's chief operating officer. He is committed to the trust and our beneficiaries, and he brings his leadership skills and passion for our mission to his position. In the role of CEO, Steve oversees the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the Trust Land Office. We know that Steve is going to do great things. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holtzman. I just want to make a quick note. Quite some time ago, Representative Thompson joined us, just for the record. And does anybody have any questions for Ms. Holtzman before we jump over to Mr. Williams? I don't see any, so Mr. Williams, take it away.
Thank you, Anita. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Steve Williams. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. It's exciting to sit here with you and to talk about the trust as the CEO. I wish my first presentation, I know this carries over for the chair as well, we wish we were there in person, but we're happy to be able to do this nonetheless. If we could please switch to the next slide. The Mental Health Trust is required by statute to ensure that we improve the lives of our beneficiaries. And our beneficiaries are Alaskans, youth, and adults who experience some of the health conditions that you see there on your screen. The trust estimates that about 1 in 10 Alaskans may experience one or multiple of these conditions. We don't have a list of names or specific individuals, but we know that the needs of Alaskans who experience mental health, addiction, Alzheimer's-related disease, dementia, traumatic brain injuries, and intellectual and developmental disabilities is great. Next slide, please. Before I go into the financial position of the trust and our FY23 budget recommendations and a couple of highlights about the Trust Land Office, Anita mentioned that we just finished a legislative audit, and I would like just to provide a quick update on the outcome of that audit. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approved an audit in March of 2020. The goal of the audit was to ensure that the trust had taken actions to address findings from a 2018 audit. And we appreciated the work that we did with the legislative audit staff as we went through this process. It's always a lot of work, but we always learn many things, and it helps us as an organization to improve as we look forward into the future. What we're pleased to report to the committee is that the legislative auditor found that the trust had successfully responded and took action to the findings that were made in the 2018 audit. And I'm also pleased to report that the trust continues to operate under and uphold state statutes and the terms of the trust 1994 trust settlement, Weiss versus the state of Alaska, that ultimately created the trust as we know it today. As I assume often happens through these processes, there are other recommendations that were identified as we went through the process, and this was true of this most recent process. In addition to confirming what was intended in the behind this original audit, the auditors made some recommendations in some other areas. They fall into the categories of commercial real estate and what I would describe as strengthening and improving our current policies, procedures, and practices. And we are looking closely at those and considering them and then taking the appropriate action to address them. Next slide, please. This slide illustrates the financial position of the trust from its inception. So moving from left to right across the screen, you can go from 1996 to the close of fiscal year 2021. And you can see that there has been steady growth in the trust's invested assets over this time period. I would note there was a slight dip there in 2008 to 2010, and that was connected to the downturn in the economic position of the United States nationally at the time. It obviously had an impact to the trust and its assets. But since then, we've seen steady growth. If we focus in on the far right bar, under 2021, the blue section of that column represents the corpus or the principal of the trust, and that represents $498 million. This is the principal of the trust that is there to ensure that we can provide support not only to present beneficiaries, but future beneficiaries. Moving up the bar to the orange colored section, that represents our budget reserves. And we target a budget reserve of 400% of our payout. And that orange color represents $268 million. And then moving up to the very top of that column, that is the gray section of the column is our real estate equity, and that is valued at $66 million. So in total, at the close of FY21, the trust's invested assets represented $832 million, and I think this demonstrates a couple of things. One, it demonstrates the strong financial position of the trust, but I would also like to acknowledge that this strong financial position of the trust could not be done without the active management of our funds through the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, through our partners at the Department of Revenue, through the revenue that's generated from the Trust Land Office, as well as the active oversight and actions taken by our Board of Trustees. Next slide, please. So this is where I will start to dive into a little bit about our FY23 estimated available funding. This is the funding that the trustees approved that is being used and was approved for certain projects and activities by our Board of Trustees this past summer. You will see that the total estimated available funding is $37 million. And the way we get to that total, I will start at the top, is The first large place that we draw our money from is a 4.25% payout of the average of the prior 4 years of our fund balances. That equals $29 million. The next row is the average of the prior 4 years of our carry forward funds at $2.8 million. The third row in that table is $4.6 million, and that's the average of the prior 4 years of the income, spendable income that is generated by the trust land office. And then finally, the $600,000 is the prior 4 years average of interest earnings, and that brings us to the grand total there of $37 million. That is an estimated total. We won't know the actual final total of that until the closeout of FY22 in early August. What you see in the table to the right is, I wanted to share this so that you all could just see the previous 5 years of the trust available funding. What I think is important, the important takeaway here is that in each year, we have incrementally grown over time. And in fact, between the increase that we're projecting of our FY22 available spending over FY23 available spending over FY22 is $1.5 million. We are hopeful and we anticipate that we will continue to see this incremental increase over time, but I thought that the committee would like to see this just to have a sense of history to seeing where we're at today. Next slide, please. I am not going to spend a lot of time walking through this illustration, but I wanted to include it in the presentation so that the committee understands that when the trust staff present budget recommendations to our board, who then ultimately make an approval, that the way we get to our budget recommendations is through a very thorough and comprehensive process. It begins in the early spring. We work with our committee member, our program and planning committee, and then the board to finally approve the budget recommendations. And then by statute, we need to present those budget recommendations to the governor and to the legislative budget and audit by September 15. This is a little bit ahead of the regular state budget process. But I believe that the reason that this is identified in our statutes is so that we can give some lead time to the administration as they are considering their proposal that ultimately gets submitted to the legislature December 15. I would also just note, and I'll talk a little bit later about this, that by statute, the trust's recommendations include the funds that were approved, trust funds that were approved by the Board of Trustees, as well as recommendations for how the state should spend general fund dollars to help our beneficiaries and to forward the comprehensive integrated mental health program plan. Next slide, please. So for FY23 spending, this pie chart illustrates three basic categories or slices of the pie that break out our recommendations. I would like to start in the top right, roughly 26% quadrant that's divided in two. There's the trust authority, and then there's the trust land office. And those two sections of the pie represent our agency budgets. These are the funds that are used for the trust authority office to administer its grants over the course of a year. We administer an award roughly around 200 grants a year. We actively manage probably between 250 and 300 grants a year. And the reason for that increase is there are some grants from previous years that cross over that are still open and we are actively managing. So our agency budgets not only are critical to grant administration, they're also critical to our advocacy, as well as forwarding our initiatives. Many of you will remember Bring the Kids Home. That happened back in 2005 to 2010, I believe. And currently, we're in a major initiative with the Department of Health and Social Services to transform our behavioral health crisis continuum of care. The Trust Land Office section, the Trust Land Office sits within the Department of Natural Resources. They are charged with managing our million acres of land. That million of acres of land is very diverse, not only in location, but in the way that land, those lands could be used. Some of those lands have timber resources, other have mineral resources. Some of the lands also have oil and gas resources. So the million acres is a pretty complex and diverse portfolio that the staff at the TLO actively manages, not only to be good stewards of the land, but to promote development that can generate income and resources for the trust that then can be deployed to support programs and services of our beneficiaries. Moving down to the green slice of the pie, MTAR, Mental Health Trust Authority Authorized Receipts. These are the trust funds that the Board of Trustees have approved for a specific state agency for a designated purpose. This year in FY23, the trustees have approved $8.5 million of MTAR funds. When you're looking at your the state budget, if you see the acronym MTAR, you can be assured that that represents trust funding. The thing that I would add to this $8.5 million of trust funds is there are some cases in the budget, and I'll get to a slide in a minute, that shows how our trust funds match some general fund recommendations. And then there are places in the budget where the trust is solely funding particular projects and programs within the state system. These MTAR grants are found in the Department of Health and Social Services, Corrections, the Alaska court system, as well as within the university. And they certainly aren't limited to those that I just mentioned. Finally, the last half of the pie, the blue, is the Trust Authority approved spending for authority grants. This represents roughly $17.6 million of trust funds. These are funds that the trust awards outside of the state system. We have the authority in our statutes to make grants outside of the state budget. These grants go to a variety of local governments, tribal health organizations, community nonprofits, and other providers, all that serve our beneficiaries. And I just wanted to make sure that you all saw that, and that represents sort of the whole picture of our proposed FY23 spending. Flipping to the next slide.
Mr. Williams, I've got a question. Also, I'd like to note, just for the record, Representative Johnson has also joined us, and we've got Representative Wool with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the chair, looking at your pie chart, looks like a quarter of your budget is your operating costs, about $9 million, $9.1 million, to administer 250 grants. How many employees does that cover, that budget?
Through the chair, just for Representative Wool, just for clarification, the $9 million is an agency budget for the Trust Authority Office, about half of it, and then the other half is for the Trust Land Office. To your question about the number of staff, there are 17 staff in the Trust Authority Office, and I believe roughly 18 over at the Trust Land Office, but I'd have to double check that.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. Moving on to the next slide. This slide illustrates what the Board of Trustees approved in terms of our FY23 MTAR grants, trust funds, as well as the recommendations that they've made to the administration and to the legislature for the state use of general funds. What I'd like to note is that the MTAR funds and these rows that you see don't list all of our MTAR grants. This table only shows you trust funds that are for projects where there is also a general fund increment. So the blue columns are what our Board of Trustees approved in August and then forwarded on to the governor and to the legislature. The top section are what we would call traditionally operating projects. They're in the operating budget. Down at the bottom, you will see capital budget items, and I was listening to the discussion a little while ago when Mr. Anderson stated that there are roughly 8 projects in the mental health budget bill that are capital items. These would be them. And then if you look, move over to the right in the gold columns, you will see what the governor included in his proposed budget. And I'm pleased to report this year that the governor has included in his proposed budget all of the recommendations that the trustees made to the administration back in September. As you might recall, last year there was a fourth column in this table called trust reserves. That does not exist this year, and I would I'd like to say that I think that the reason that it doesn't exist this year is because of improved coordination with not only our state departments, but with the governor's office and the Office of Management and Budget. As we prepared our final recommendations, they engaged with us on some priorities and some recommendations that they would like the trust to consider. Those were considered. And in fact, if you look at the very bottom row titled Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Senior Housing Pre-Development, that was a request of the governor's office that our board considered and included in their budget recommendations. So it's great to see that we are back in the historical practice of what gets included in both our recommendations to the governor and the legislature, as well as what got included in his proposed budget.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair, I'm just trying to understand can you draw the correlation between the pie chart on page 8 and the spreadsheet on page 9? Is there a direct, I see the MTAR column, which totals 3.7, and a few other numbers. So maybe I'm missing something, but if you could align the page 9 with page 8, that would help me out.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's a great question. So on page 8, the total MTAR, which are trust funds that the trustees have approved, is $8.5 million. When you flip to page 9 and you look at that table, you see the total of MTAR of 3.7. This table only illustrates the MTAR increments where there is a GFMH recommendation. The other roughly $4.2 million of MTAR funds that would then bring us to the total of 8.5. The other MTAR funds are for projects that the trust is solely funding. So there is no GF associated with it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, I see no other questions. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go on to the next slide, please. So this slide basically gives you a high-level overview of how our trust funding is deployed in a variety of focus areas and other priorities that have been established by the trust and our trustees over the years. I'm not going to walk through each of these in the interest of time, but these focus areas should not look too unfamiliar to the committee. They've been around for several years, and I would just note that if anyone is interested in the details of each of these focus areas, sort of the strategies behind them, the issues that they're intended to address, our trust website has a page dedicated to each of these where you can get a lot of detailed information about the focus areas and what their intent is to do. I guess the one thing on here that I would like to highlight is the very last bullet under additional priorities, early childhood intervention and prevention. This is an area that the trust is engaging more and more in. We are recognizing, and this is not new news, that we need to be working a little bit further upstream so that we are intervening earlier to get better outcomes and hopefully maybe even to prevent individuals from becoming trust beneficiaries. So this is work that we're doing related to trauma-informed care, related to adverse childhood experiences with our state partners as well as with the community.
We got a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair. Is there anything currently being done for pregnancy? I know that really leads into success in early childhood. And so I guess I was just curious if there's any outreach in communities about healthy pregnancies and even prenatal care.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't have any information off the top of my head. However, I will note that, and we can follow up with the committee with information about how we are or aren't engaged in that area.
We've got a question, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, through the chair. If I go to the website to find out more information on each one of these, is the website also going to have an assessment on measures of success in each one of the areas, such as key performance indicators or something to communicate how well you think you are doing at these, or is that something that we need to have another conversation about?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, if you were to go to our website, when you made your statement, I was thinking of maybe a dashboard. I don't know if that's what you were envisioning, but I would say that there is not a dashboard. However, and I can walk you through this maybe in a separate conversation, there is information on all the grants that we have awarded that have performance measures and outcomes associated with them so that you could actually see, you know, grant X, this is what it was intended to do, and here are the outcomes as a result of that funding.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Williams, would you consider pre-K part of the early childhood intervention and prevention?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, to the extent that we are talking about young children who are at very high risk of being trust beneficiaries.
Thank you.
Okay, I see no further questions. Please continue.
Thank you. Next slide, please. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide. It may speak a little bit to Representative Carpenter's question about outcomes and areas that we're working. These are trust authority grants that have been recently awarded. We selected these because they're really focused on increasing access to mental health and addiction treatment, those top three bullets. And then the bottom three bullets are areas that we are working on to address homelessness and prevent homelessness, as well as being able to provide opportunities for our beneficiaries to go to one location to be able to access resources and get referred to services if needed. What I'm referring to in that statement is the second bullet, which is the $150,000 down at the bottom to the Southeast Community Center Hub in Juneau, the Teal Center. I'm assuming that some of you are aware of that. It's out near the airport, and it's actually located right across the parking lot from the Glory Hall Homeless Shelter there in Juneau. The trust is really excited about this particular project because the Teal Center is going to house a number of nonprofit organizations whose services benefit our beneficiaries. And being located literally across the parking lot from the Glory Hall will assist individuals from making that transition from a homelessness status into a more permanent housing situation. I would just, I mentioned increased capacity, the $300,000 for the behavioral health, residential mental health treatment beds in Fairbanks. That's increasing that service type by 16 beds, and the same for the Arc of Anchorage here in Anchorage, another 16 beds. Next slide, please.
Got a question, Representative Rasmussen?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. It was brought to my attention recently that there are housing options for families, for single mothers, individuals, but we seem to be lacking in housing for single fathers. I was just curious if that's something that's on the radar. Are there actually facilities for single fathers throughout the state? Could you just help clarify that for me?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I'm not sure if you're speaking to like a specific apartment unit or facility just for single men, or are you just talking about having increased access for single men in for housing?
Through the chair, if I could follow up. Yeah, so it was brought to my attention that there were no shelters or places for a single father to go with his children. So he would either have to send his children somewhere. It seems like there are places in place, obviously, for single mothers, but I had heard that we may not have a place for single fathers. If they fall homeless, I should clarify.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Rasmussen, for the additional information. I think what I'll do is I'll take down that question and I will connect up with our program officer here at the Trust, Kelda Barstad, and we'll get you that information and present it to you and the other committee members as well.
Please continue.
Thank you. Great. We're on the current slide. I mentioned when I was speaking to the FY23 spending and that pie chart and the work that the Trust Authority Office does to forward initiatives that are really transformative and change and improve our system of care. This is what we are doing in partnership with the Department of Health and Social Services and have this work we have been engaged in for the last 2+ years. Currently, our current behavioral health crisis response system is reliant on largely on law enforcement, EMS, and hospital emergency rooms. We know that that is not the appropriate nor the most effective response for someone who's experienced a behavioral health crisis. So we have been working with the department and stakeholders in the community to redesign the way we in Alaska respond to a behavioral health crisis. And we're using the Crisis Now framework, the components of it are there on your screen, as our sort of roadmap for work in this area. We're engaged, and maybe we can flip to the next slide, please. Thank you. We're engaged right now heavily in 4 communities. We're engaged in Fairbanks, the Matsu Valley, Anchorage, and Juneau. We are in conversations in rural locations with Nome, Kotzebue, Ketchikan to look at how this framework could be used or adapted in those locations, recognizing that they may not have the resources that exist in an urban center that is on the road system. We are working with stakeholders. I've mentioned the Department of Health and Social Services, but this includes other stakeholders like local law enforcement, local government, the Alaska State Troopers, other state agencies, and community providers. But I really want to highlight for the committee that this also includes the input and the guidance from the individuals with lived experience who have experienced the behavioral health crisis, have accessed the services to address that crisis, and recognize that while they may have made it through that crisis, it may not have been the best way to get to stabilization. This includes not only the individual with lived experience, but many family members who have had loved ones go through the system. It includes our advocacy partners, like the chapter, the NAMI chapter of Alaska, as well as our NAMI affiliates in Anchorage and Fairbanks and in Juneau, as well as our statutory advisory board, the Alaska Mental Health Board. I'm sharing this with you so that the committee and anyone who might be listening is aware that as we're moving this initiative forward, we are bringing together as many of the different perspectives and those who have experience to redesign the system so it can be the most effective and the most efficient in the end.
Got a question, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair. Excuse me. Yeah, Mr. Williams, I first of all want to thank you for your work on this project and your continuing effort. And I've heard from you guys for a little while now on this, and I support it 100%. And I guess I'm just checking on sort of the status of when it'll be operational. And are you getting the support from the Department of Health and Social Services that you need? Are you getting the financial support from the state that you need as well? And I see there's two bill numbers at the bottom, and maybe you can explain those. But I guess I'm asking for a sort of progress report and a when do you think we'll be? I know up and running is a vague term, and there's a lot of different moving parts here, but. If you could address sort of the status report and if you're getting the support that you need.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, thank you for that question. You were, in some regards, were reading my mind because I wanted to highlight the $807,000 increment in that second row that is funding the Fairbanks Mobile Crisis Team. This is a mobile crisis team made up of a mental health clinician and a peer, someone with lived experience. And Fairbanks has stood up a mobile crisis response team, and maybe you are aware of that. They started operating in November. They started off with sort of a reduced response in terms of schedule or capacity. And then starting in December, they are now operating 24/7 in the city of Fairbanks. Maybe a little bit further out towards the university. I'm not quite 100% sure how far out there their kind of perimeter is. But in December alone, they responded to 40 calls from dispatch. And those 40 calls represented 23 unique individuals. And they were able to resolve the situation on the scene in 29 of those 40 calls. So, and I think I just saw this data a couple of weeks ago. I think of those 40 calls, only one time was there a need for a law enforcement presence as well. So, we are starting to see the components of the framework implemented. In Anchorage, the fire department operates a similar type model. It's more of a paramedicine model, but it is a step in the right direction. We are working with our partners in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Matsu Valley to start to be able to stand up. And maybe if we could just go back one slide. Stand up that 23-hour crisis stabilization component. And this will get to your last question, I believe, Representative Wool. The bill number is at the bottom of the next slide, please, SB 124 and HB 172. This was a bill that was introduced by the governor last legislative session. SB 124 had a couple of hearings in Senate Hess, and HB 172 has had a few hearings in House Judiciary. And these bills essentially amend a very narrow section of our Title 47 civil commitment statutes. And what it does, what the intent is behind this, is to allow mobile crisis teams, for example, if they were interacting with me in the community, and my mental health crisis was so acute that I was a danger to myself or danger to others, and they were not able to basically encourage me to go with them to the 23-hour crisis stabilization center, they could take me into protective custody for that short period of time to make that transport so I get to the appropriate place with mental health professionals, peers, and medical professionals to address my behavioral health crisis. So that is the reference to those two bill numbers. And I just to build on, we are continuing to move forward with the implementation of the components, not just in Fairbanks, but in the other locations as well. In terms of resource, right now there is a recommendation, a GF recommendation. If you were to flip back to the table, I'm looking for the slide number for slide 9. And if you were to look at under the operating budget items, about halfway down, Crisis Now Continuum of Care grants, a request of $900,000 of general funds. Those funds would be used to help in conjunction with trust funds to work with to continue the implementation of the model.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for that information, and I'm glad it's running in certain areas, and I wish it success, and I think it's sort of the step forward as opposed to police intervention in jail, and this is a much better alternative, and I'm glad that the numbers that you gave us and the success, and I wish it more success, and I certainly support it.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for Mr. Williams, the Fairbanks Mobile Crisis Teams program, are you familiar with in Fairbanks a program, the Community Service Patrol, that has been operating for a number of years now? And is there a partnership between the Fairbanks Mobile Crisis Team and the Community Service Patrol in Fairbanks? And could you describe how that works, if there is a partnership?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I'm very familiar with the Community Service Patrol there in Fairbanks. I, when I was a program officer here at the Trust, I worked directly with David, and I'm blanking on his last name, who's the executive director, to get the Community Service Patrol up and running there in Fairbanks. The Trust was a funder at the very front end of all that and helped to pull together the community to sort of develop that service. In regards to your question about the connection between the Community Service Patrol and the Mobile Crisis Response Team, I'm sure there is a connection. I don't have the specifics on that, but the way the connection would be, when a call comes in, it's going to dispatch. And then the individuals who operate dispatch are assessing the situation and are making a determination based on the information as to which response is most appropriate. So I can get you and the committee more information on that, but I think it might get to your question.
I just was curious if you were aware of the program, and it sounds like you are, and it would be a natural partnership between the two to work together. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you. And I see no other questions. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could flip to slide 14. Hard for me to tell on the screen. Are you all on slide 14?
Yes, we are.
Great, thank you. The next two slides, I just wanted to highlight the work of the Trust Land Office. The Trust Land Office is an important arm of the Trust. As I mentioned earlier, They're statutorily charged to manage our million acres of land, to make sure that we're good stewards of that land and that we're able to maximize the revenue from those lands for the sole benefit of the trust and its beneficiaries. The Trust Land Office is housed in a special section within the Department of Natural Resources. The executive director is Justy Warner, and she has an incredible team that works with her to manage those trust lands. The relationship between the Trust Land Office and the Trust Authority Office, and I give credit to my predecessor, Mike Abbott, who really, when he started, saw the need to be able to really provide community education about the relationship between our two offices. Because the Trust Land Office is generating revenues that the Trust Authority Office then can be used to grant out for programs and services to improve the lives of our beneficiaries. For a long time, and I will reflect back to when I started, the two offices were often never connected. In fact, here at the Authority Office, I rarely saw folks from the Trust Land Office. Today, that is a very different picture. We are working together. We are informing them about what their fund, the revenue that they're generating, and how it helps to improve and carry out the mission of the trust. And they're sharing with us some of the activities that they're undertaking to be able to generate that revenue. So that is something that myself and Justy are gonna continue to do whenever possible, is to be able to present together to the community so that they see the interrelationship between trust lands and the work of the Trust Authority Office, both working together with sort of different responsibilities, but towards the goal and the mission of the trust to improve the lives of beneficiaries.
Got questions from Representative American and Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I would like to congratulate both of you on your new roles. We appreciate everything you're doing. I had a couple questions. Is it possible for the committee to get a list or a map of the land holdings that the trust has?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, absolutely. I would also just gotta do a little PR here, point you to our website, and in the on the Trust Land Office section, there is actually an application where you can find electronically and see where all the different parcels are, as well as a very brief description of the parcel.
Okay, perfect. I guess I don't need the list then. And follow up? I was told that there's a piece of property in Eagle River on Wolf Den Drive, and can you confirm that? And if so, at a community council, I was told that that piece of property is being looked at for a cemetery, and I was seeing if there was any validity to that.
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, I am going to have to get back to you and use the expertise of Ms. Warner and get you the answer to your question, if that's okay.
Great, super, I appreciate it.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when I look at that chart on graph or on slide 14, under the heading of minerals, I'm suspecting that's mining. And I'm suspecting that the bulk of that $1.1 million per year might be coming from Fort Knox near Fairbanks. Would that be a true statement?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, yes.
And it's also my understanding that the Mental Health Trust has enjoyed a lease arrangement with Fort Knox that's extended for many years, and that the Kinross gold mine at Fort Knox has paid north of $20 million to the trust. Would that be correct?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, north of $20 million over the life of our relationship with Fort Knox.
And that's my understanding.
Yes, I will have to defer to you, Ms. Warner. I don't want to overstate something. My suspicion is yes.
Yeah, I think it is a yes, but I just want to acknowledge the importance of mining to the trust, and what a partnership that has been built over many years with the Fort Knox Gold Mine. Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, following on the subject of mining, which I do support, and I support Fort Knox, and I'm glad they've had such a prosperous run. There was a mental health trust lease recently in the Fairbanks area to another mining development company, and it was in a quasi-residential area near where I live, and many of the community members came out in opposition. I'm sure you are aware of the Esther Dome area and Murphy Dome Road area. And the mining, you know, everyone was in their right and acting legally, and the lease, they said, well, they're leasing us, giving us the lease, and we're going to, you know, start doing some exploration. And anyhow, I guess my question is, do you look into the sort of social impact or regional impact or community impact before you approve these leases? Because this one didn't go over well, as you know, and the Mental Health Trust name was bandied around quite a bit, and it wasn't all positive. So what's your response to that? Because, you know, I understand the good work you guys are doing and how you use the money and help your beneficiaries, but at the same time, it didn't look good for you guys there for a while. So what's, and we've heard from other investors, and I think ESG, environmental social governance, and terms like that are thrown around, and I don't know if this qualifies for that, but it definitely had a community impact that was not positive. So just wondering what your response is to that.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes, we are aware, obviously, of the two projects that you just referenced. And yes, we do consider the community and the interests of the community as the trust land office. And this is, it's important to note that the executive director of the trust land office is the individual, and that is the entity that manages the lands with the sole interest of the trust in mind. Having said that, input from the community as those decisions are being contemplated is sought and considered as those decisions are being made.
Representative Wool.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm glad that's happening. I guess maybe in this case, it seems like it got a little too far along before it seemed to be reeled back in by the mining developer, not by the mental health trust. But I'm glad it's being considered, and hopefully we'll continue in earnest. Thank you.
Okay, I see no further questions. Please continue.
Representative Foster, thank you. And before I go on to the next slide, Representative Laban, I got some information from the cyber world that says actually it's north of $25 million that has been generated over in our partnership with Fort Knox.
Thank you.
Finally, this next slide, I just wanted to highlight that the Trust and the U.S. Forest Service have completed a land exchange that has been in the works, in my recollection, starting in conversations back in 2005. This has been the result of obviously consistent and forward effort to get us to this point. It included local governments, local communities, state and federal governments, individual members, as well as the state legislature and our federal delegation. In fact, I'm looking at the screen and looking at Representative Ortiz, who I'm sure remembers back in 2017 as the co-sponsor of a piece of legislation, SB 88, I believe, that was critical into forwarding and getting us to this point. So appreciation for that. But this land exchange, between the U.S. Forest Service and the trust was really important, not only for the trust, but also to meet community needs. You know, this maybe speaks to a little bit about what Representative Wool was talking about just a second ago. But we were able to, through this exchange, preserve certain lands that had been identified by the public for public use so that they wouldn't be developed because they wanted to preserve view sheds or be able to use them and access them for other public uses. And then in exchange, the trust was able to get lands that could be developed on Prince of Wales Island, as well as some lands in the Upper George Inlet, in Shelter Cove. And the end result is that an exchange happened that was able to meet multiple needs. This doesn't often happen. You don't get to see these things come to fruition where you have so many different stakeholders with so many different priorities being able to resolve on a final product that is what I would describe an excellent compromise and a demonstration of goodwill. And from the trust perspective, we anticipate that as a result of this exchange, that we are going to be able, the Trust Land Office is going to be able to generate between $25 and $30 million over the next 10 years that will then be used to improve the lives of our beneficiaries. So I just wanted to highlight this. I think it is something we certainly here at the Trust, and I know our Board of Trustees are celebrating as an accomplishment, and it's an accomplishment, I think, for all. My final slide. So in closing, I hope I'm leaving the committee with the sense that the Trust has strong leadership at our board level, within the Trust Authority Office, as well as the Trust Land Office, that the Trust is in a strong financial position and is interested in using that strong financial position to partner with others to forward programs and services for our beneficiaries, that we have multiple partnerships, including the legislature, our fellow state departments, tribal health, community providers, and individual beneficiaries, and through and together, that we all can improve the lives and the impacts for our beneficiaries. I thank the committee for listening to this presentation. I look forward to working with the committee as the budget moves forward through the process, and I'm available for any questions if there are any.
Okay, Representative Carpenter and then LeBong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would like to go back to slide 11 for a question, and the thinking that I'm having here is in relation to the governor's speech last night where he indicated a desire to focus on ending homelessness. I'm looking at the supported efforts here, and the slide is communicating impacts that have happened or are occurring. To the tune of $650,000, the Mental Health Trust Authority is supporting efforts to end homeless, and it looks like those entities that are recipients of those grants are private organizations of some sort. I don't know if there's a state general fund match in regards to those, or whether all that money is all mental health trust money solely. I guess one of the questions that I would ask, seeing a dollar figure and seeing it spread around the state, would be how many former homeless individuals or families are now not homeless, have their own homes, and can keep their own homes. If we're supporting efforts, I mean, it's the government's nature to spend money. Nothing on this slide communicates the results. I mean, I don't want to be too critical because we've got limited time here, but how many people are employed out of that $650,000, and how many people are not homeless because of that effort, or how many people were not prevented homelessness? Because everything that I see within the state right now is that the problem of homelessness is continuing to increase. And I'm not sure whether that's a function of awareness, we're just more aware of it now, or whether the numbers are actually going up. So I would be interested to have some further detail on, and especially in relation to what the executive branch thinks it's going to want to do here in the future regarding homelessness. How is the Mental Health Trust Authority addressing the problem, and then how is the rest of the state agencies going to address the problem, and is there a nexus of efforts there, or are we duplicating efforts? I just want to get a better picture of that, and this doesn't really communicate the end product here, what we're actually getting for the money that's being spent.
Mr. Williams, do you have any comments?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, you're absolutely right. Those three bullets do not demonstrate any outcomes. The intent of the three bullets that were highlighted here, and just for everyone's understanding, these are trust funds that go directly to community nonprofit organizations. They are not part of the state budget process. And so our board of trustees actually had to approve each of these few projects. These are solely trust funds. And I would note that these funds don't necessarily represent the total cost or the investment for a particular program or service. The trust works collaboratively with our partners at DHSS, AHFC, the Alaska Housing Coalition to End Homelessness, the local coalitions to end homelessness in various communities, to try and do exactly what I think you're describing there, Representative Carpenter, which is to make sure we're not duplicating efforts, make sure we are channeling our limited resources to the fullest extent possible so that we can achieve the outcomes and maybe even use resources for other needs other than just this particular area. We can certainly provide some information related to outcomes from trust grants that illustrate some outcomes for individuals as it relates to going from a homelessness status to what I think I heard you describe as like more of a permanent housing situation. And I would just add from a trust perspective for our individual beneficiaries, the house itself, the unit itself is really, really important. But for many of our beneficiaries, the community-based services and supports that are needed to wrap around that individual so that they can maintain their housing and not inadvertently slip back into a tenuous situation that may result in homelessness is equally as important. So we'd be happy to get you that information and even set up a time to talk it through with you if you would like.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would appreciate that, a follow-up conversation. And I guess what I'm ultimately looking for is for individuals to be self-sufficient. I don't want to see state agencies or state-supported agencies creating constituencies that require state support to continue living. That just creates larger budgets. I want to see people becoming independent, and that ought to be what our purpose is to get them back on their feet and get them to be productive members of society without state support. Thank you.
Representative LeBron? I'm sorry, Mr. Williams, did you have a comment?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I agree with you. There are absolutely individuals, as a result of their circumstances, have the capacity to move forward out of that particular situation into a permanent housing and continue on with their life with minimal to no government intervention. For our trust beneficiaries, that may be the case for some, but that certainly will not be the case for others as a result of just sort of their individual health condition. I'm thinking of individuals with intellectual developmental disabilities, things like that, where they will probably need, there will be a certain portion of the population that will require those ongoing services and supports to be able to fully engage with the community to the fullest extent possible.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on your final slide, you mentioned the trust's strong financial position, which raises for me the question that if we looked at slide five, so we're going to go back, but that was the slide that kind of showed your history from 96 to where you are today with your financial position. So I'm looking at the slide, and it gives me a little bit of a question about, or raises the question of, how much in reserves do you target to hold? Right now it looks like it's about 30% of the total financial position. Is that healthy? And then what corporate policy or philosophy do you have with rolling reserves into the corpus, or do you have one? Is it a year to year and the board just takes a look at that relationship and then makes decisions on a year to year basis? I'm just curious about your philosophy about the relationship between reserves and your corpus.
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the blue section of that column is the corpus, the $498 million. So that is there, and that the trust cannot draw down on the corpus. Our target for budget reserves is 400% of our annual payout. So that target was set several years ago when we had Callan come in and work with the Board of Trustees to look at what should be a realistic and an adequate mark for a budget reserve. Those budget reserves are intended to be able to be accessed in the downturn of a market so that we can maintain our grant obligations during that period and ride that out. And that is actually something that we're currently revisiting and looking at whether 400% is or isn't the right amount.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. I guess to reference some of the efforts that, you know, some nonprofits have done, just to highlight, Beans Cafe, I know, has started a program. They were recognized at the mayor's inaugural breakfast as the beneficiary of all of the donations, I guess, raised. It was a fundraiser for them, and they highlighted basically starting to transition people who were homeless and customers, I guess, of Beans Cafe, if you will, and have become employees of Beans Cafe and put in, you know, temporary housing to kind of get them back off their feet. And it sounds like the project could use a lot more resources, frankly, but it seems to be a bit of a pilot. And I guess my question with all of this is, we have something in place being executed well through Lisa Souter, the executive director at Beans Cafe, and I'm curious, is there currently any land held by the trust that could be cleared? Is it suitable farmland and possibly employ Alaskans who kind of need to be reintroduced into the community, into a workforce in farming, since we also have a food security concern in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I could connect up with the folks at the Trust Land Office to see what parcels exist and whether or not any of those would be suitable for something like that. Again, I just want to remind the committee that when the Land Office is looking at our land assets, they are weighing a number of different considerations. One of them is interests of our beneficiaries, but the others are how do we maximize the revenue from those lands for not just for our current beneficiaries, but for our future beneficiaries, which is what we have to make sure as a perpetual trust exists per statute.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Um, our, Are you aware of any programs in other states that basically build small communities around a farming concept with small houses? I mean, we clearly have a lot of land, so it seems like, and farming would be something that would be renewable, whereas some of our, you know, mining and oil and gas are unfortunately finite, and we will not have an endless revenue stream from those items, but we could continue to farm and make money long into the future.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I am not, but again, I am sure Kelda Barstad, our program officer, who is really engaged in the housing and homelessness efforts of the trust, might be, and be happy to provide that information to you and to the committee.
Okay. I see no further questions. So with that, both Ms. Halterman and Mr. Williams, thank you very much for your presentation. It's been very descriptive and good dialogue back and forth. So I think we got a lot of information today. If there's nothing else to come for the committee, our next meeting will be at 1:30 p.m. tomorrow. We'll hear from the Legislative Finance Division, the Director, Alexi Painter, on the baseline budget and the governor's 10-year plan. So with that, we will be adjourned at 3:11 p.m. Thank you.